This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, we discuss a thaw that could actually end up heightening tensions around the world. And as you may have guessed, it's about a subject that rhymes with mimet mange.
I can gather what that rhymes with. Also, another national security hawk is coming out in support of Hillary Clinton. We break down what lifetime CIA operative Mike Morrell had to say about the Democratic nominee, including some interesting tidbits he failed to mention in his endorsement.
And later in the show, we sit down and chat with a real-life Republican. John Gray with Conservative Review joins us to talk about his feelings.
Yeah, I'm picturing this as like a group therapy session or an intervention, asking him why he's supporting Donald Trump. But first, let's get off the dang campaign trail for a moment here. Don't worry, we're going to get back on it later in the show. But I want to talk about something else we learned about at the end of last week. And that is just what in the hell the FBI was doing flying spy planes over Baltimore last May, during the protests over the death of Freddie Gray. Freddie Gray, of course, the individual who was arrested by Baltimore police, put in the back of a paddy wagon or police van where he died, where he suffered a ruptured spine, basically, severed spine.
Yeah, the police took him on what they call a rough ride, which, right. According to people in the community, in the Baltimore community, they've been doing that for years as kind of a punitive thing.
Yeah.
And also, just quickly, I think it's important to note that Gray, it was later found, was arrested illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And the coroner said that his death was a homicide.
Yes. And not a single officer was charged, or they were all acquitted, basically.
Right.
They were charged. None of them will end up facing any punishment as a result of this. So after all this happened last May, there was some unrest in Baltimore. There was a lot of marches agitating for Black Lives Matter rights. And at the same time, it was reported that there was FBI planes flying above, basically recording everything that was happening in the city during these days. Now, thanks to a Freedom of Information Act request by the American Civil Liberties Union, the FBI has released 18 hours of video surveillance of Baltimore taken by planes that the feds were flying over the city between April 29th and May 3rd of 2015. Those planes, by the way, were registered to front companies, not to the FBI. They were registered to front companies in an effort to conceal that they were actually being flown by the feds. Anyway, the ACLU has reviewed the hours and hours of footage, and here's some of what they found. First, the video show people engaged in First Amendment-protected activities, people entering and exiting homes and other buildings, images of private backyards and roof decks, and other similar scenes and spaces. I'm reading here from the ACLU's analysis. The videos also sometimes tracked individuals' drivers as they traverse city streets. This footage, the ACLU notes, can reveal a great deal of potentially sensitive information.
Yeah, the thing about private backyards is particularly troubling because it seems to me that you'd have what is legally known as a reasonable expectation of privacy in your own backyard.
Yeah, you would think. Also, these videotapes, the surveillance footage, showed on three different occasions drones flying above the city. It's unclear whether these drones belonged to just drone hobby enthusiasts, journalists trying to capture something, or whether these were also belonging to law enforcement. Currently, the FAA prohibits you from flying drones unless you're in a line of sight and they're low altitude. These did not seem to be low altitude drones, and who knows if they were in the line of sight of anybody. But as ACLU noted, these videos raised a lot of questions. Moreover, these videos are just the tip of the iceberg. A recent BuzzFeed News investigation tracked more than 4 months. They tracked FBI and Department of Homeland Security surveillance flights and identified nearly 2,000 flights by FBI aircraft. The camera footage from those flights adds up fast and could create a detailed catalog of people's activities in cities across the country. Again, these are 2,000 flights captured by BuzzFeed News, FBI flights, not over Baltimore, but over other major American cities around the country. ACLU says the quantity of surveillance created by all this requires strong controls. But during a hearing last October, Comey defended the domestic surveillance flights. He said, quote, "If there is tremendous turbulence in a community, it's useful to everybody, civilians and law enforcement, to have a view of what's going on. Where are the fires in the community? Where are people gathering? Where do people need help? And sometimes the best view of that is above rather than try and look from a car on the street." That's what Comey's claiming. Now, quick note here. Comey identified two very, very different things that the Fed should be keeping an eye out for. One, where are the fires? And I can understand that during, you know, violent riots, perhaps a bird's eye view is one of the best vantage points for cops. But his other reason for the flights, to see, quote, where are people gathering? That's a little different than trying to figure out where the fires are. That's a protected First Amendment activity, which is not necessary to be recorded by the cops way up in the sky. Now, this is all problematic because the feds can glean a lot of information by just recording cities for prolonged periods of time. The ACLU notes that the FBI's planes weren't flying low. When zoomed out, their cameras captured large swaths of the city at once. But the camera's magnification capability is strong, and they frequently focused on a single intersection, followed a single car, or tracked the movements of small groups of people on the streets. And because the planes were so high in the sky, they probably escaped the notice of most people on the ground. As I mentioned, Baltimore is not an isolated incident. The BuzzFeed report tracked 2,000 flights by FBI aircraft. Well, you know, again, the FBI is not obtaining a warrant on this stuff. The controls that the ACLU is recommending here, non-existent. So, anyways, that's a story we're going to keep track of. Sam Knight, I understand you have some other stories worth mentioning.
Yeah, we've been the purveyors of bad news recently.
No,
I mean, you know, as journalists, it's kind of our job.
We just threw someone in the garbage can last week. That's always good news.
Indeed, but. The bad news we've been keeping an eye on and reporting, it's kind of got a bit of an apocalyptic tone, really.
Yeah, that's true, I guess.
You know, we've recently talked about Donald Trump running amok and Hillary Clinton's abject militarism being the country's response. That's kind of scary. We've discussed how stock markets are completely out of control with investors, for example, not even bothering to check who actually profits from Pokemon Go. Remember when Nintendo's stock fell by 17% overnight because markets thought it made the game? That was ridiculous.
Yeah, that doesn't give you much faith in the financial system.
No. And of course, as we chatted about on Friday, the U.S. government has just granted approval for corporate space travel to a company that eventually wants to mine the moon. I mean, what could possibly go wrong there?
Yeah.
They also said they want to be a fourth superpower, by the way, because three other superpowers have been to the moon, U.S., China, Russia. Some of them unmanned, obviously. So I want to keep these dystopian headlines. I want to keep that train rolling. This time, it's environmental. As we discuss in our latest edition of The Sludge Report.
Oil spill stretching for miles.
A torrent of methane gas is spewing into the air.
The Sludge Report.
So according to a recently published article in an academic journal called Geophysical Research Letters, climate change could cause an abandoned U.S. nuclear submarine base in Greenland to contaminate the environment nearby by the end of the century.
As you promised, this is apocalyptic as hell.
The facility is called Camp Century. It was built in 1959 and decommissioned and abandoned in 1967 with very little oversight. It was done under the assumption that its hazardous waste would be forever contained by accumulating snow and ice. But the planet had other plans. Or maybe I should say the people living on the planet had other plans.
Yes, like burn the hell out of as many fossil fuels as we can.
Yeah, so as I'm sure you know, snow has been receding in Greenland with the globe warming, as it's called, global warming. And according to the research, the continuation of this role would, quote, guarantee the eventual remobilization of physical, chemical, biological, and radiological waste abandoned at this site, Camp Century, of course, in Greenland. Reading more from the report here. The last reported U.S. Army Corps of Engineers visit to the abandoned Camp Century site was in 1969. Nice. Well, no. 69 joke for you. The report also noted that aside from the reaction chamber of the portable nuclear generator, which was removed for destructive testing, all infrastructure remained in the collapsing tunnel network after the 1969 survey. Are you scared yet, buddy?
Well, we've been over this before. I'm scared all the time. Constantly racked with fear.
Now that you mention it, same here. But this seems to maybe sound a lot worse than it actually is. You know, I know that the idea of a melting nuclear submarine base spilling contaminants all over doesn't sound great, but okay, so the research notes that the main contaminant from this scenario would be chemicals called polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCB, not to be confused with the drug PCP, or angel dust.
I didn't know you like to get wet.
Thanks, Wayne Brady. Anyway, the main health risk from PCBs comes from exposure, which shouldn't be that much of a problem with Greenland being very scarcely populated.
Yes, I learned from Mighty Ducks a long time ago that Greenland is in fact full of ice and Iceland is in fact very green.
There's also ice in Iceland, though, and the entire premise of that movie was about Iceland having a hockey team, and they don't really play ice hockey in Iceland. So I hate to throw some water on your blanket there. But anyway,
okay,
we're moving on. So the contaminants, you know, they're bad. Not a lot of people in Greenland, so that's, I guess you could call it a positive note, trying to find a good... Anyway, the environment is probably going to take another one for the team, though. It might not be so lucky. A Christian Science Monitor noted that, quote, when the toxic remnants are exposed to the open ocean, surrounding ecosystems will likely suffer devastating consequences. And the research itself also noted that this ticking time bomb could cause, quote, a new pathway to political dispute associated with climate change, not just in Greenland, but elsewhere, with industrial waste in previously inaccessible areas that are now becoming accessible with shifting planetary conditions, aka global warming.
Yeah.
So, Sam, I don't know. What are you more scared of, toxic contamination or conflict caused by unthawed nuclear waste? I mean, either seem pretty crappy to me.
Yeah, they're both pretty crappy. And let's just have this be a reminder that nuclear power is bad, because this is the same sort of problems we're going to confront maybe 1,000 years from now, 10,000, assuming we make it that long as a human race here. We are producing huge amounts of nuclear waste and are storing them in these places that assume are going to be safe indefinitely. Yeah. But as we just learned by a plan that was hatched in 1959, really just a little more than a half century ago, that plan is already bunk.
Yeah.
Let alone our plans to store nuclear waste for 10,000 years, how can we possibly predict the certain types of climate that's going to exist on the planet and the fortresses that we construct to hold this nuclear waste will actually hold?
Well,
we can't.
You know, it reminds me of that classic saying, the best laid plans of mice and guys who throw nuclear waste away often go astray.
Yes. Before we close things out here in the block, let's do one more story here that's of interest to the 99%.
Home Street! High Street! Home Street! High Street! Home Street! High Street!
So Sam Knight briefly mentioned Pokemon Go a little bit in sort of an apocalyptic context. Well, we have another Pokemon Go story for you right now, because we know that we have tons of Pokemon Go fans that listen to this show, and we want to let you know that we hear you. No, definitely not. Now, according to a report in The Hill last Friday, apparently there's now a Poke Lobby here in Washington, D.C. The Pokemon Company International, which owns licenses to the various Pokemon characters, but is not the maker of the game itself. Attention, investors, don't run out and invest in the Pokemon Company. Actually, don't take my advice. I'm not giving legal advice. I'm just giving you information of who actually owns the Pokemon game. Anyways, they just hired a lobbying firm, Greenberg Traurig, to handle its affairs in Congress. The game's extreme popularity has piqued the interest of lawmakers, and not necessarily in a good way. We've reported how some legislators have raised concerns about privacy. The game used to require users to hand off access to their Gmail accounts when playing, That policy was reversed after a lot of bad press on it. But that's just one misgiving that lawmakers have around Pokemon Go. There's concerns over the data usage. It sucks a lot of data up, which affects people's cell phone plans. There's concerns about bad actors using it, from child pedophiles who might want to prey on kids by getting a Pokemon Go account, or burglars who might be trying to lure people to Pokemon gyms or something. I don't know. I don't play the game. I've just heard about this stuff. Then there's the inconvenient locations that the Pokemon occasionally pop up in. Lawmakers were outraged that some appeared within the Holocaust Memorial here in Washington, D.C.
I gotta say, I share that outrage a little bit. That's pretty absurd.
So naturally, it looks like lawmakers might be sharpening their knives on the game, maybe introducing regulations. So the response to all this, Pokemon Go is getting in the lobbying game. Hill also reported that one of the lobbyists working on behalf of the Pokemon company is a former Republican senator from Arkansas, Tim Hutchinson. So I know a lot of former lawmakers and government officials have gone through that lobbying door, that revolving door. Very few of them have encountered a Charizard on the other side. More unanimous dissent coming up. And welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams still here with you from Washington, D.C. All right, let's dive back into politics here. But before we do that, we're going to need to relocate to a more secure setting.
We need to get into classified session.
Right away, Secretary. Now, Lifetime spook Michael Morell is positioning himself, it seems, to once again head the Central Intelligence Agency should Hillary Clinton win the presidency. He penned a fawning op-ed in the New York Times at the end of last week, praising the Democratic nominee. He said, quote, "I am neither a registered Democrat nor a registered Republican. In my 40 years of voting, I have pulled the lever for candidates of both parties. As a government official, I have always been silent about my preference for president." Then he writes, quote, "No longer. On November 8, I will vote for Hillary Clinton. Between now and then, I will do everything I can to ensure that she is elected as our 45th president." Morell, by the way, is an ardent defender of the CIA's most controversial tactics, including drone strikes and enhanced interrogation, also known as torture. He also works at a PR firm run by longtime Clinton advisor, which Morell didn't disclose in his New York Times op-ed, by the way. The former CIA deputy also echoed the charges that have come out of the Clinton campaign that Donald Trump is some sort of agent of the Russian government. He writes, quote, "President Vladimir Putin of Russia was a career intelligence officer trained to identify vulnerabilities in an individual and to exploit them. That is exactly what he did earlier in the primaries. Mr. Putin played upon Mr. Trump's vulnerabilities by complimenting him." He just responded, and he responded just as Mr. Putin had calculated. "In the intelligence business, we would say that Mr. Putin had recruited Mr. Trump as an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation." Right.
That seemed to work out real well, because it seems like Hillary's definitely going to get elected now.
Yeah. If Morell is right, though, then on the bright side, all it takes is a clever compliment from President Obama to get Trump back on good old Team USA. Anyway, here we have another national security official who worked under Bush praising Hillary Clinton's foreign policy chops. Should this be concerning to those of us who aren't interested in seeing yet another generation of American soldiers fight wars of aggression around the world? Well, joining us to talk about this is investigative journalist, filmmaker, and musician Robbie Martin. You can check out his work over at Media Roots, and you can watch his latest project, a three-part movie called A Very Heavy Agenda, which you can find at averyheavyagenda.com. Hey, Robbie, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So last time we had you on the show a few weeks ago, you were in studio, you were in Washington, and you were carrying a suit with you, which is a bit out of character for those who know you, but it was because you were planning to go to a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton that was featuring Robert Kagan, one of the signature neocon influences here in Washington, D.C., fierce advocate of the Iraq War and basically any war the U.S. has fought over the last few decades. And he's a former advisor and current supporter to Hillary Clinton. We wanted to bring you on again to tell us how that fundraiser went since you attended it. So how'd it go?
It was a really bizarre experience. I honestly, when I went, I thought it was going to be a lot more off the record and kind of more, you know, more milquetoast and just boring than it was. And I guess the most interesting part about it was that Kagan was extremely talkative, and I had a chance to ask him, you know, why he's a Hillary supporter and if he thinks that Hillary Clinton will send the weapons to the Ukrainian army. And he kind of answered, you know, this is sort of like before he went up and talked, because he spoke at this event.
Yeah.
So was this kind of like in a crowd full of people?
Was this before or after you got that smiling picture of you and Robert Kagan?
It was before.
Okay.
So what was funny is he obviously had no idea who I was. He didn't find my question hostile in any way. I mean, I was approaching him as if I was genuinely a Hillary supporter and concerned about, you know, Ukraine. So what the most interesting thing he said to me was, is I was like, well, what's the deal with, you know, why is Obama seem like he's dragging his feet a little bit on Ukraine? And he turned to me and he kind of laughed and said, well, it's because Obama said to me he doesn't want a nuclear war with Russia.
Seems reasonable. And,
yeah. And so, but the way he said it, he thought it was like mockable. And so I said, that's literally what Obama said. And then he responded, yeah, he's through with his agenda with Putin. I don't think he cares about Putin anymore at all. I think he's hopeless. He thinks Putin is hopeless, but he says he thinks Ukraine is part of Russian sphere of influence and that it means more to them than it means to us. And therefore we shouldn't escalate in a situation like that. And that's why he doesn't want to send arms.
I was just going to ask you, I might be getting a little sidetracked here, but really quickly, did you happen to ask him how he could sort of put forward that idea when George W. Bush basically kind of took the same policy in 2008 when there was a similar conflict between Russia and Georgia?
I didn't have a chance to ask him about that, but I've heard him speak on that before. And he was one of the main people going out there trying to push George W. Bush to be more aggressive towards Russia and Georgia. I mean, he was, you know, kind of a canary in the coal mine back then, where he was very critical of George W. Bush.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with some of these neocons, is they're nonpartisan in the sense that even PNAC, when George W. Bush was not invading Saddam Hussein right after 9/11, they were writing him letters saying, what's going on? Like, why are you taking so long to overthrow Saddam Hussein? Like back in 2002. So, you know, they've always been there trying to push even, you know, George W. Bush to a more hawkish direction. But it was funny, because when I said, you know, Obama actually said he doesn't want nuclear war over Ukraine, and he's like, he did. He said he doesn't want to have a nuclear war over Ukraine. And my response is, well, who do you want to have a nuclear war over? Do you want to have a nuclear war over Estonia? Do you want to have a nuclear war over Germany? If that's your going in position, then okay, fine. Whatever nuclear countries don't want, we won't do. And the way he said it almost sounded like a petulant child to me, like who just was miffed that Obama doesn't want a nuclear war with Russia. I mean, that's how ridiculous it was.
And just so our listeners who might not be familiar with Robert Kagan know, this guy isn't just some think tank guy by himself. He's sat in the room with policymakers, with Hillary. He was on Hillary Clinton's advisory council. He's been there as people have made these important decisions.
Exactly. Yeah. And his wife still works for Obama. So I just thought it was strange, you know, on a human level, that it was strange that he was mocking Obama for this while his wife is still working for him.
So what did Kagan say about how Hillary Clinton would operate differently than President Obama is currently?
I mean, he didn't say much to me directly about that. He said that all he said was that Hillary cares a lot more about the Ukrainian people than Obama does, which is kind of coded to mean that she, you know, she would be more invested in that situation than he would be. But then in his speech, he went on to explain that Hillary Clinton has a very strong understanding of this quote unquote transatlantic relationship, in the idea of a Europe whole, free, and at peace, you know, sort of this, which is really a Clinton era, Bill Clinton era project that was started you know, with this huge NATO expansion in the 90s. I mean, he was basically saying that Hillary Clinton understands this world order and the importance of maintaining these alliances and relationships and standing up against Putin. And he really wasn't even saying it like in contrast to Trump. That was the interesting thing to me, is I feel like a lot of this was sort of subtle shade throwing at Obama. Like, by contrast, you know, Hillary understands these things kind of without saying it, but that Obama didn't, you know, that Obama chose to pull away and things like that. So, I mean, I think that this event and a lot of the things that were said at it is a pretty clear indicator that not just, you know, Hillary Clinton is more electable for neocons than Donald Trump, but that she's actually an ideal candidate for neoconservatives far more than Barack Obama, and that her foreign policy will be far more hawkish than Obama's.
I've got to ask you this. You know, Hillary obviously came out against the TPP. She says she's against it. But we've seen people try to make the case for the TPP in a national security framework, that the agreement needs to be signed and implemented and, you know, passed to sort of counterbalance China in the Pacific. Was there any talk of that at the event, sort of the idea that Hillary could find room to, you know, finagle her way out of her position on TPP based on national security grounds?
You know, there wasn't. There was no talk about China. It was all about NATO and sort of the Eastern Bloc and our responsibility as the world's superpower to sort of keep Europe safe and whole. So I think that their focus on China is definitely something, like, the neoconservatives are definitely looking at China and focusing on it. But I think that they know that right now is not the right time. There's not a window, and there's not really an opening for them to jump on that completely yet. I think they're waiting to. I mean, I think that what we saw with their approach to Russia is they were talking about Russia in this sort of hostile, adversarial way years before, and it all sort of blew up here in the U.S. press. And then once it happened, they were already all prepared with all the right talking points, all their, you know, information, lockdown. So if we see an opportunity with that debate to come up about China and the TPP, I think the neocons will be right there with all their stuff in order and you know, talking points ready to be, you know, spread all around the media and stuff.
Was there any acknowledgement of what happened in Libya? I noticed that a lot of the NATSEC officials who've come out in support of Hillary Clinton, they write this glowing op-ed about her and how well experienced she is and what a calm hand she is. But none of them mentioned Libya, which was one of her top initiatives as Secretary of State, was the overthrow of Gaddafi. There's that video of her saying, we came, saw, he died. So, and even in this op-ed that Morrell published in the New York Times, he doesn't mention Libya at all in there. So I was just curious if that came up in the topic, or how maybe Kagan and the others view what happened in Libya in the aftermath of Libya. How does that fit into their framework of what U.S. intervention and NATO intervention is capable of around the world?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because it's one of those examples where, because, let's just put it this way, there wasn't necessarily a stronger neocon position about what we should do in Libya than what was actually done.
Yeah,
I don't think the neocons are pushing for like a ground invasion. They pretty much got what they wanted out of Libya.
Right.
So I think that because it ended up being a kind of a disaster, they just don't talk about it. They just simply omit it from the record. Now, what they do talk about is Syria, because in Syria, they can always say, because neocons are amazing at boxing liberal interventionists in, they can always say, well, you didn't go hard enough on Syria. And because of that, you know, the Islamic State has risen there. And it's funny, because in Michael Morrell's editorial, he says something else in there that I think is also another form of shade throwing at Obama. It's sort of emphasizing that rift that took place in the Obama administration, where he says, quote, during the early debates about how we should respond to the Syrian civil war, Hillary was a strong proponent of a more aggressive approach, one that might have prevented the Islamic State from gaining a foothold in Syria. So that is, to me, a very, very, you know, appealing thing to neoconservatives. This is a stark difference between her and Obama, where Hillary would have actually, you know, stuck to that, you know, that red line kind of standard that Obama put up. And that the neocons tried to hold his feet to the fire and be like, look, he crossed the red line. Now, you know, now go in. You know, so it's kind of shocking that Obama didn't at that point.
And of course, with Russia and the United States both having interests in Syria, this could be a real flashpoint if the fighting is still going on in January 2017, when assuming Hillary is sworn in then.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of why we've seen Obama, you know, kind of, maybe begrudgingly working with the Russian government to try to like pull out of Syria, kind of synchronize a pullout date. I mean, that I can't say that's happening absolutely for sure, but that's what it seems like has been happening.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, for all of Obama's hearty endorsements of Clinton and, you know, his dutiful campaigning for her, we also remember a few years ago, there was a story that came out that after Hillary left the administration, that there was a big split between them based on Obama's mantra, his foreign policy mantra, which is a simple mantra. And it's don't do stupid stuff, although I think he uses a swear word that starts with an S and ends with H-I-T. So, yeah, I mean, I was just going to say what you said there about Syria, there could be some, you know, Obama could very well be very tentative and cautious and nervous about what Hillary Clinton will do.
Robbie, just to kind of wind things up, we've kind of touched on this idea of a realignment with the neoconservatives going over to the Democratic Party. Not to say that the Democratic Party hasn't flirted with those foreign policy ideas for a while, but assuming Clinton's elected, don't you think that these guys like Kagan and the rest of them are more comfortable in a Democratic Party rather than a Republican Party that's, you know, so tied to religious extremists and cultural values and things like that? They'd rather just stick with Democrats in kind of a war foreign policy. It's easier for them. We got just about 30 seconds. Sorry to kind of cram it in there.
I think it's really important for them to do that. I think that they never really, they only used the religious evangelical climate of this country as a tool. So if they can actually get the liberal and left side of the spectrum to be these sort of, to have this sort of weird warped form of American nationalism, that's extremely effective for them. And it harkens back to Irving Kristol's Encounter magazine, which was a CIA funded magazine in Europe designed to eliminate Cold War neutrality among European liberals who just didn't care. And I think that that's a huge important thing for these people, is to get liberals and Democrats to basically get behind this, you know, American hegemony. Hmm.
Robbie Martin with Media Roots. You can watch his latest project. It's a movie called A Very Heavy Agenda. I recommend it. You find it at averyheavyagenda.com. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Sams. Take care.
More Unanimous Dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com.
As our listeners know, Sam and I think that Donald Trump isn't a Republican outsider, that he's the product of decades of Republican policies and vitriol. The xenophobia, the Islamophobia, the desire to bomb the Middle East, the unconditional support for cops, all of it we believe is, you know, pretty standard for the Republican Party, despite the Never Trump movement and the slew of right wingers who have or are in the process of abandoning the Donald. But right now, because variety is the spice of life, we're going to bring you a completely different perspective. Today, we want to explore what conservatives actually think about Trump and the Republican Party, particularly in light of his recent campaign disasters. So today we have brought you a real life right winger into the studio to do just that. Joining us now is John Gray, the senior editor of Conservative Review. He's also a former analyst at the Heritage Foundation and a former staffer on Capitol Hill, where he worked for Senator Rand Paul and former Representative Mike Pence. And he co-hosts a weekly debate podcast alongside us, the two Sams, called Capitol Fight Club. You definitely need to check it out. There is fighting, and it's definitely within the proximity of the Capitol. And John is currently sitting right next to me.
In real life.
In real life.
Are we sure he's not a hologram?
John, are you a hologram?
He might be. I don't know.
Oh. So tell me, John, let's get right to it. Trump had a pretty rough week here last week. Do you see any silver lining, or is there too heavy a touch of gray?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the Sams.
Thanks.
Yeah. And, well, you know, the irony, I think, is really that it seems like every week has been a bad week for Trump in mm-hmm. some way or fashion. This week in particular has been a little brutal for him, and I don't know that it's going to get a lot better. He's a very difficult person to want to support.
Yeah.
Even though I think conservatives are constantly trying to figure out how to support him.
So tell us how you do it, John.
Well, I mean, so for me personally, it's actually been a huge sort of conundrum for me in the sense that, as I've told our listeners on the Capitol Fight Club, I used to work for Mike Pence. So
right. There's
a lot of loyalty factor there. And I've definitely been looking for the sort of silver lining in Trump, the good parts of him, what he's been saying that I can support. But it is difficult. And as you know, I think that this entire election is difficult for America because I don't really see too many good options all above.
You know, we might, for different reasons, I think we both agree, Sam and I.
You spoke, mind if I jump in?
Go ahead.
You mentioned you used to work for Mike Pence. You've gotten to know the guy a little bit just working with him. How do you think he's approaching all of this? I'm sure when he signed on to be the VP, Trump's VP, he had to have known what Trump had been doing beforehand. But do you think he imagined it would keep getting worse and worse and worse?
I suspect he probably hoped it wouldn't.
How does Mike Pence deal with adversity, as you know, from what you know about
him? So I've thought about this, and actually I think there's sort of three pillars to and I haven't talked to Pence about this, but I think there are probably three pillars to his thinking. On the one hand, I think he probably is trying to be a savior for the Republican Party. He's looking as like a calm, reasonable voice to balance Trump. I think the Republican Party is desperate to bring a more pragmatic approach to this election that helps offset sort of the vitriolic nature of Trump. And so I can see Pence being that way. I think there's also the aspect, you know, who doesn't want to be vice president of the United States?
Yeah.
So I think there's the personal goal in there. And I also think, you know, Pence is, he's always been a very optimistic guy, and I think that he is trying to see Trump as a guy who may be a good voice, a big personality on TV in terms of trying to get elected. It's worked for Trump for some reason, and I think Trump keeps moving in that direction. And the way I could see Pence looking at it is that, and the optimistic view is that Trump will be okay when he's actually in charge, or if he would be in that.
So we've been seeing some chatter. I think it's mostly from, you know, the sort of West Wing worshipers over at MSNBC. But we've seen some chatter about the idea that, like, that Trump might not be the nominee at this point, despite the fact that they've had a convention and everything else. People are sort of it seems to be wishful thinking more than anything. Do you think there's any possibility of, I don't know, Trump sort of saying, you know what, I don't really want this anyway. Let Pence take it, or let, you know, Ted Cruz run. Do you think that's just a fever dream, right?
Well, you know, I think you have to put yourself in a situation where you can't rule anything out with Trump. So
true.
I can't go on record for saying absolutely won't happen. However, looking at Trump, looking at the type of person he is, I can't imagine he would drop out.
Yeah.
At this point, I mean, you know,
that's a loser thing. He's not a loser.
Yeah, he's not a loser. He's going.
He'd rather lose. Yeah.
And I think he's gonna continue to run. I don't think the polls look very well for him right now. So maybe that weighs into his decision. That being said, I think he will probably be on the ballot.
Do you think it would be better for the Republican Party if he did somehow find an off ramp and exit the race before November?
Maybe. A thought that has occurred to me and has occurred to a lot of Republicans, actually, which I'm really hesitant to say publicly, but The one silver lining for Republicans, particularly a guy like me who's had a background in some of the libertarian politics and we've been frustrated with the Republican Party for a long time, is that we do hope that whatever Trump represents helps lead to a change. The Republican Party needs a change desperately. And at this point, I even think the Democratic Party needs a change desperately. And to some extent, if Trump breaks up the party, I see a lot of Democrats who are supporting Trump, maybe the more civil libertarian type Democrats who are frustrated.
I'd like you to name these Democrats who are supporting Trump.
Do you mean Bernie?
Sanders.
Sanders
supporters. Yeah, exactly. I think there's a lot of disenfranchised voters in both parties. And I think really all it would take is for one party to really sort of just break apart to some extent. If you had a party, I think, a Republican Party that split more into the Amashas, the Rand Paul type crews, I think that would be attractive to the sort of Reagan Democrats, maybe even the Bernie supporters. When I was working on the Hill, I always looked at Bernie and Rand. And while they have some major differences, they also have some things that are really in common.
Yeah, I know. I mean, over on our other show, Capital Fight Club, I think we find ourselves surprised by, the issues that assuming that we were legislators, we could work on together. It also kind of seems like there's just this crazy realignment going on that no one really can put their finger on. But it kind of seems like, you've got, for lack of a better term, the neocons backing Hillary as one faction. You've got the Trumpers on the other, and then you've got libertarian types and Bernie types. The whole lot's up in the air right now. I don't know.
Talking about the libertarian types, and there was actually some polling that Politico reported on that looking at third parties as an aggregate, Gary Johnson and Jill Stein together, more younger people, particularly younger people, but people in general, those votes are being pulled more so from Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump, even for Gary Johnson, not just Jill Stein. So at the same time, though, we do have Republicans toying with the idea of endorsing Gary Johnson. We saw, which Bush was it?
There were rumors that Jeb was going to endorse.
But instead it was his brother, Marvin Bush, who ended up endorsing him.
Well, actually, I think Jeb threw out a pseudo endorsement as well.
That's my question. Do you think we're going to see more mainstream Republicans sort of embrace this third party idea to defeat Trump and actually jump on the Gary Johnson train?
Well, I actually had a long discussion with a number of Republicans over lunch about this today, in fact. And
this is one of those high power lunches that occur in Washington, D.C., folks. John Gray privy to him all the time.
Yeah, very high power. You can't even imagine.
Was it at that restaurant, that seafood crab? Johnny's Half Shell or something?
Well, I wish it was, but they went out of business.
Did they?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, see, we don't know. We don't go to the power lunches. Yeah.
Sam Knight and I walked past that place the other day and saw Geraldo Rivera giving a stand-up interview or something there.
Oh, yeah. He was really nice. I was very intrusive and took a picture of him with my iPhone. And instead, he's turned and smiled and waved. It's obviously not the first time that's happened to him.
He turned, removed his shirt, and flexed his muscles for us.
I wish.
All right, tell us about your lunch.
The lunch. What's interesting is a lot of my friends, a lot of Republicans want to vote for Gary Johnson. Yeah. They like him. I've danced in libertarian circles for a long time, even within the Republican Party. And there are a lot of Republicans who want to vote for him, but are being told a vote for Gary Johnson is a de facto vote for Hillary Clinton. And I think what we came to the conclusion at lunch is that's just complete crap.
Right.
And really, you can't think like that. You have to vote your conscience, as Ted Cruz said. But really, but really, that is true. I think it sort of dilutes the democratic process when you're basically told you really only have two options because you don't. Yeah. You have three options.
I mean.
And so I think this is weighing on a lot of Republicans, but I actually, today I really am confirmed in, at least in myself, that you can vote for Gary Johnson and you can feel okay about it.
Sounds like John's wavering a little bit on his Trump support through the weeks here.
I've never been a huge Trump supporter. I do like Mike Pence quite a bit, and I think he would be a great person to sort of be in the White House, but.
What do you make of Paul Ryan in all of this?
Oh, yeah.
He's gotten pretty thoroughly embarrassed by Trump. He was completely owned last week when Trump's like, I'm not quite there yet on endorsing Paul Ryan. I'm not quite there yet, which was the exact same language
that
Paul Ryan said about Trump. But Paul Ryan also said that his support for Trump is not unconditional. What do you think Trump could possibly do between now and November that would get Paul Ryan to ditch his support? I mean, you would think not endorsing Paul Ryan would be something, but then again, Paul Ryan can't drop his support because of that. He would look petty as hell considering all the other bad stuff Trump has done. So what might lead to the Speaker of the House finally saying, all right, that's it. I can't be with Trump anymore.
Well, I think there are a lot of factors. Paul's going to have to weigh whether or not he wants to sort of abandon his mantle as the sort of the leader of the Republican Party as a speaker. And I think there's a lot of pressure on him to continue to support whoever the nominee is. On the other hand, I can see Paul not actually being that upset that Trump's not totally supporting him, because I think there's a lot of things that Trump is saying that Paul can't back. And I don't really blame him for wanting to not necessarily get Trump's blessing in total. But what I am noticing in the election, and particularly with Republicans, is that the association with Trump is weighing heavily on the election. If districts or states are very pro-Trump, the candidates seem to be more inclined to take a softer approach to him or even support him. So I don't know exactly what the First District of Wisconsin is like at this moment, but if it's very pro-Trump, I think Paul is going to take a pretty approach.
Yeah, well, there was a poll that just came out that said, like, Paul Ryan's up 66 points on
Paul Malin.
Yeah, on his primary challenger.
Whose office or whose campaign sends me press releases, and I just adore them because they're so goofy. I mean, he did a James O'Keefe thing where he, quote-unquote, crossed the U.S.-Mexico border holding a box that literally said it had drugs painted on the side. For dramatic effect. I love that guy. I want to see him. I want to see him in Congress so bad.
He's got quite an uphill to climb. Speaking of that, how concerned are you, John, about GOP control of the House and Senate? Does Trump really threaten that, or does he bring out a lot of energy in voters who might vote down ticket Republicans to preserve it?
Well, I'm going to reveal more secrets that really aren't secrets, but I'm not so worried about the House. I think the House will be okay.
Because of gerrymandering? Because you guys got that, that stuff rigged.
2020.
We've taken care of the House. It's all wrapped up. I think the Senate is a totally different ballgame. I think we're going to lose the Senate, and you know what? I don't really feel that bad. When I was in the Senate, I don't hold the leadership there in very high regard. I don't think very highly of Mitch McConnell. I think some of the Tea Party people who ran on principle surrender those principles, they may lose, and I'm not going to shed
Would Mitch lose his minority leader gig if they became the minority?
So. I'm praying.
It would be, I guess, John Cornyn to take over?
Maybe, but you never know.
Yeah.
You never know if I think the Republican Party, clearly by this election, we need a big shakeup, and maybe it's Cornyn, and maybe he'll do okay. I haven't made a decision on whether or not I could support that or not, but I think we need a big shakeup.
Did you see that photo the other day that Boehner posted of himself toasting with wine after Hustle Camp?
Yeah,
lost his primary. Hustle Camp, of course, the Tea Party congressman, one of the people who forced Boehner out of office last year. It seemed like Boehner got the last laugh there.
Yeah, I think Boehner is just enjoying Boehner. You know, I'm smoking lots of cigarettes, drinking wine, having a good time.
Yeah, I really want to chain smoke and drink wine with that guy. I'm not going to lie.
It would be fun.
That's my bad left-wing opinion, is I want to hang out with John Boehner.
We've got just a little bit of time left. I've been talking with some friends of mine on the left, and we were just trying to conceive of what, if things turned around and if Trump won the election somehow, we were trying to think of what a Trump inauguration would look like. When he's up there on the platform, the Capitol steps with Barack Obama right next to him, usually something that's very historic, there's a lot of respect, a lot of decorum. How do you think that would play out if Trump is the guy that's up there on Inauguration Day giving his inaugural speech? You think he would just like turn and bash Obama the whole time he's up there? Do you think he has it in him to be this sort of presidential figure, or would it just be another Trump show that we've seen?
Well, interestingly enough, I've thought about this a lot.
I think the whole country has thought about this a lot.
Actually, it excites me. So I think the way it unravels is, It really starts with basically, I mean, it's already been done before. The WWE of Trump walking into fireworks. You know, I don't even know. Maybe he's in like a Hulk Mania suit. Who knows? But it would probably be spectacular and just over the top. And then, you know, he comes in and maybe he gives some strange speech and starts yelling about babies.
I can only imagine that the person most horrified by all this would be Barack Obama.
It will be epic.
Anyways, we're out of time. John Gray, thanks so much for coming on. You can follow him at John_W_Gray. And you can listen to him on our podcast that we all share together, Capital Fight Club. That's going to do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. And stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay right here in D.C. so you don't have to be.